Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hear me? Can you hear me on the phone?
Like you, I've got you coming out of every orifice.
I'm really not, you're breaking off quite badly.
Hello and welcome to The Lock-In, where I finally get to talk to people I want to hear from in a place I want to be, the pub.
For some reason, this bloody thing has started playing back some rubbish.
Oh, right.
Where were we? I forgot.
I have too.
We're locked in today with a man who's up there with John Flamsteed, Edmund Hawley and Frank Dyson, the man who invented the Pips time signal. I'm talking about Martin, Lord Rees, who, like the others, is Astronomer Royal. As well as being the nation's foremost astrophysicist or stargazer, he's also one of the founders of the Cambridge Centre for the Study of Existential Risk, which is what we're going to talk about. In short, are we all doomed? Martin, how's your lockdown been?
It's been guiltily comfortable, as it were, because I've been in Cambridge in quite a nice house and I've been able to do lots of Zooming and giving lectures all over the world, indeed, not just to North America and Europe, where I fly often, but to places I wouldn't so readily fly to, you know, Latin America, lots to India and things like that. So I've been fairly productive in a sense in lockdown and got some writing done as well. But it's been really bad for the students here at Cambridge University.
Because they're deprived of one-to-one contact.
Yes, well, there has been some sort of tutorial one-to-one. The big lectures are now video, but that doesn't matter too much. But they've been deprived of normal student life, really. Big gatherings and informal social events, etc. And to be fair, they've done much better in Cambridge than in many other universities. I mean, if you read about what happened at Northumbria and Manchester, it was really dreadful.
Has it made you think more about existential risk?
Well, I think I've been concerned about this for a long time, but I think the pandemic has made the public realise that it's not just flaky doom mongers who worry about these global catastrophes, but they really happen. And so we are moving into a world where we are so interconnected, so dependent on technology, that we are more vulnerable than before. And so I think COVID is an example of a globe-spanning catastrophe, and it makes us worry that things like this could happen. We can imagine things potentially far worse than COVID, with a much higher fatality rate, for instance. And I think it's become a serious issue. We've realized that these disasters can spread globally in a way that could never happen before.
I know you're a scientist and prefer evidence to anything else, but if you had to take a bet, mortgage your house, if you had to bet your house on whether this was a naturally occurring thing or something that was man-made, what would you decide?
I think, to be honest, I would say it's more likely to be a natural event in that it was transmitted from animals via the food markets in China, etc. But it's not at all implausible to say that it did leak out from the Wuhan laboratory where they were doing experiments of this kind. So that's a possibility. But one of my worst nightmares is that the kind of technology to make viruses more virulent and more transmissible, which was available for the influenza virus 10 years ago, is now becoming more feasible for other viruses and more widespread. And my worst nightmare is that there could be intentionally engineered releases of viruses, which could happen anywhere. And it's very, very hard to regulate against that, because it's not like regulating people who might build a nuclear weapon, because that needs large special purpose facilities. Doing these experiments on viruses can be done in the kind of labs that exist in many universities and many industries. And I really worry about the greater likelihood, increasing likelihood, of bad actors, as it were, fanatics of various kinds, who may release a bio weapon. And also, of course, the same concern about cyber attacks, which are getting more serious. And I think globally, in order to cope with this threat, where the village idiots of the world have global range, we're going to have a very difficult trade-off between three things we want to preserve, namely liberty, privacy, and security. Because we can't afford even one person to be able to clandestinely do this sort of thing.
That is terrifying.
I think it is.
So that's the sort of thing that keeps you awake at night, is it?
That's the thing that worries me most, actually, yes. The fact that individuals are empowered by bio and cyber technology to do things which could even cascade globally and certainly have local catastrophic effects. And I think if you think about bio, of course, bioweapons haven't been used very much in war, and they wouldn't be used by a terrorist group with well-defined aims simply because the consequences are unpredictable and have no threat. But there are a few people, for instance, environmental fanatics, who think there are too many human beings in the world. And if that was combined with this sort of fanaticism, they would not care who they killed.
What are we to do about it?
Well, as I say, it's a trade-off between privacy, liberty, and security. We can obviously do what we can to monitor all these labs and the people who have access to them. And also, we can make sure that certain types of experiment are prohibited in organized laboratories to try and slow down certain technologies. But that's pretty ineffective. So it's honestly something which I don't see an easy solution to.
That makes it much, much more difficult.
That's right.
If it were easy, of course, someone would have had an answer, wouldn't they?
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you are looking at active threats.
The engineered threats are an add-on to the kind of natural pandemics which we are experiencing now, and which, of course, have happened not all that rarely. And indeed, I like the maxim of Nate Silver, that the unfamiliar is not the same as the improbable. And these pandemics are unfamiliar, but no one could have said it was terribly improbable, given that there'd been SARS and MERS and there'd been influenza pandemics. And of course, we could have something far worse. The nightmare would be something with a very high fatality rate, which could spread. I think another point to bear in mind is that social breakdown would occur if hospitals were completely overwhelmed. You can make a contrast with the Middle Ages, when, of course, they had bubonic plague, which killed up to half the population in some towns and villages, but the rest just went on fatalistically. But now, I think if the death rate exceeded 1% of the population, it would be hard to avoid real social breakdown, because that would much overwhelm the capacity of hospitals. And everyone would clamor for the treatment which they knew was available, which they weren't themselves getting. And I think that's the kind of thing that I worry about.
People would fight to be treated, you mean?
I think they would, don't you? That if things got that bad, of course in this country, and in North America, the figure's about 0.3% who have died of this, and one fears in Brazil it may be closer to 1%, and we see what's happening there. So I think this is a real concern, and of course. To inject a little bit of optimism, one thing that should be done clearly is to increase the effort of the WHO in trying to catch a new virus before it spreads. I mean, to make sure that any farmer in Vietnam reports any strange disease in his animals, and obviously shut down these so-called wet markets in China and all that. So we can, with greater efforts, try to reduce the probability of these outbreaks, and that's clearly worthwhile. And the other thing we learned, certainly, from this pandemic is that it would have been worth spending a great deal more money on preparedness, because the figure that's quoted for the cost to the world of this pandemic in the next few years is $20 or $30 trillion. And in that perspective, given that it wasn't hugely unlikely, an insurance premium of several hundred billion dollars would have been worthwhile. And of course, far less than that was spent. Otherwise, we'd have had protective clothing and all these things, and accelerated even further the development of vaccine technology, etc.
But the WHO, which is the only organization you can point to there, the WHO has shown itself to be useless, hasn't it?
Well, it's suboptimal, but given its limited resources, I wouldn't deride it, and I think we've got to work with it. And for Trump to withdraw from it was indeed surely counterproductive. We've got to work with it and extend it so that it is able to actually respond immediately and monitor any possible outbreak. Clearly, it could have done far better, but I think we should not disparage it. It's the best we've got.
It's the only thing we've got.
Yep. Mm.
Well, that's not very encouraging, is it?
No. We've got to hope it's going to improve, but this is a real challenge, and we just have to hope that the politicians can at least agree on funding in a much bigger way these types of activities of the WHO, supplementing what's done by national authorities.
Do you worry about artificial intelligence?
I do, but not quite so much. I mean, of course, the two separate issues. One is that the kind of AI we have now can be misused, because it learns on big training sets, and it absorbs the biases implicit in those sets. For instance, if you use it to sift out the a shortlist from thousands of applicants for a job, then it looks at what's happened in the past, and there've been all kinds of biases, obviously, in the past, and it incorporates those. So it's very hard to eliminate biases, and I think many of us are going to be reluctant to feel that any decision important to us, be it whether we are let out of prison, recommended for surgery, or even denied credit, should be made to by a machine, because we feel that we are entitled to contest any such decision. And if we can't do that, we are unhappy, even if we are told that on the whole, the machine does a better job than any human. We still feel that it could have hidden bugs in it, and so we don't want to leave decisions to it. And there's another problem, which is that machines learn by looking at very large data sets or thinking very fast. For instance, the machine that beat the world champion at chess and Go, it played against itself. It can play several games per second, and that's how it can learn very fast. And it can look at millions of images of dogs and cats and things to learn to recognize them. And of course, it learns to translate by looking at millions of pages of, say, EU documents in different languages, because it's boredom threshold is fortunately infinite. And so it can learn that way. But what it can't learn is common sense, because that can only be learned by looking at real people in real environments. And for the machine to do that, first, it needs better sense organs. But secondly, it's too slow. It's like us watching trees grow. It's too slow for us to learn. And so that's the big problem, to learn common sense. So this is a short-term issue. But if we go to the longer term, of course, there are people who say that the machines will achieve human capability in more areas. And then there's a risk that they will, as it were, get out of their box, interact with the Internet of Things, and actually cause massive disruption, aiming at goals which are possibly idiotic, but certainly misaligned with what human wishes are. So that is something which is worried about. I think this is not an immediate worry. Some people think this is something which could happen in 20 years' time. There's a guy called Ray Kurzweil, who works for Google, who thinks we'll be downloading our brains into machines like that. But I'm more on the side of another expert, Rodney Brooks, the inventor of the Baxter robot and the Roomba vacuum cleaner. And he says that for a long time, we need to worry far less about artificial intelligence than about real stupidity. So that's my line.
When you say real stupidity, what do you mean?
Well, I mean human stupidity, as we have always...
Humans will do something silly.
Yeah, yes.
Tell me about your bet with Steven Pinker.
Yes, well, Stephen is a friend, and of course he is a great optimist. He's a wonderful writer, and he wrote a book 4 years ago called The Better Ends of Our Nature, which gave lots of statistics on the way things improved. Life expectancy, literacy, and all these things are improving, and this is true. I'm not contesting that, but he somehow doesn't take into account that there's this new class of concerns, which are, in a sense, a consequence of the advancement of our civilization and its greater internationalization, which are things like cyber, bio, and all these things I worry about. He, in my view, underplays all of those. And we disagree on this. And we did have a bet. There's a website in America called Long Bets, which allows people to make public bets on issues like that. And we had a bet, and it was that by the end of 2020, bio error or bio terror would lead to 1 million deaths. And I said it would, and he said it wouldn't. Now, of course, what actually happened has slightly complicated how we interpret the bet, because clearly we've had an event which is far worse than that threshold of 1 million deaths, and something which Stephen obviously never expected. So we've got something bad. But of course, I put in the proviso in the bet that it should be bio error and bio terror and not natural. And there again, of course, as we said earlier, it's unclear. It's possible it was an error, a leakage from a lab, but that's not likely. And so we've decided to suspend how we decided. In a sense, we've both lost, because neither of us expected such a bad pandemic, whereas I was perhaps more prepared for it than he was, because he was so optimistic about the future. So the question of whether it actually did escape from the Wuhan laboratory is something which we don't know. And frankly, as we say in a joint article we wrote recently, it might be better if we never know, because of course, if it were definitely proved that some kind of negligence in that Chinese lab had caused this global catastrophe, then of course, the story would have a real villain. And given the attitudes, particularly in the US, this would certainly have a major effect on international relations. So I think it's probably better if we never know. We can never settle this bet.
But we never will know, will we? Chinese are going to deny it.
But probably not. I mean, I think in principle we might discover it. For instance, we did discover that a foot and mouth epidemic in 2007 in this country was due to leakage from the Perbrite lab. We did do that, but I think, you know, given the sensitivity of the Chinese, I don't think we will ever know. It would take a long time anyway. And it's good that we don't know, I think.
You've been using terms like optimism. Are you an optimist?
Well, I like to say I'm a technological optimist and a political pessimist, because the fact is that we couldn't feed the present world population of 7.8 billion were it not for technology, growing more food and all the rest. So clearly we can benefit, and we could benefit a great deal more, because even presently understood technology would allow us to provide a good life like we enjoy for everyone in the world. But it clearly isn't, because of the massive inequalities within countries and between countries. So I'm an optimist of what technology can do, but a pessimist about the growing gap between what could be done and what is being done. And this is where I disagree in my sort of philosophy with Steven Pinker, because he quite rightly points out that everyone is better off now on average than people were in the Middle Ages. That's certainly true. However, the gap between the way things are and the way they could be was not very great in the Middle Ages. There wasn't very much they could do to improve things. Whereas now we are indeed better off, but the gap between the way we actually are in the world today and the way we could be is widening. There's a huge gap. And so I disagree with him in that there's not much evidence in sort of collective ethical progress.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Are there others in the world who are studying the same sort of things and coming to different conclusions? Conclusions which could lead you to be optimistic?
I think there's some, but I think our main point, and that's why we've set up a research group in Cambridge to address these sorts of issues more seriously and draw on the convening power of our university, etc., to bring expertise to bear. There is somewhat more interest in these things, but still disproportionately a small amount, because there's a huge amount of interest in small risks like reducing carcinogens in food, train crashes and things like that. But there are probably in the world, probably now 100 or 200 people who are seriously thinking about how we can minimize these kinds of global catastrophes, which are unfamiliar, but not necessarily improbable. And I think COVID is a wake-up call. I mean, in this country, there's certainly growing interest in our work in government, etc. And in fact, one thing I've been involved in is a House of Lords Special Select Committee addressing this issue, which has actually done quite a serious job. We've had 20 all-morning sessions of evidence with all kinds of experts, and we're doing a report. So that's a small contribution, indicating that the government is taking these things seriously. The short answer to your question is that we need to worry more, because it's worth paying a big insurance premium, as it were, to enhance preparedness for events that may seem improbable, which will be so utterly catastrophic if they occurred.
Are you able to itemize what paying that bill would involve?
Well, of course, that's hard, because we mustn't just prepare for the last war, as it were, to prepare for a repeat. And to give an example, we were prepared for an influenza pandemic, because we'd had one in this country, but we weren't prepared for the special features of a coronavirus-type pandemic, which required protective equipment for everyone involved, and also was difficult to develop a vaccine against, etc. So we weren't prepared. And I think if we consider all the different kinds of diseases that could happen, if we consider the consequences of cyber attacks, then I think what we can do is just generate robustness, etc. One thing we can do generically, I think, is to shift the balance between what I'd call resilience and efficiency. Two examples. If we depend on a single supply chain and just-in-time delivery for manufacturing cars or something, then of course that's vulnerable to the breakdown of one link in that chain. And it's far better to have multiple supply chains and keep an inventory in stock. That's costs extra money, but it's worth it. And likewise, I think the German health service, unlike the British one, had a policy of keeping at least 20% of intensive care beds empty except for a special emergency. Whereas here we pride ourselves on the great efficiency of using all the beds. So those are two examples where one can enhance resilience at the price of paying a bit extra for the services. So that's the kind of thing we can do, which is a generic benefit. But of course, if you take cyber, this is a very serious threat if there is, for instance, a breakdown in electricity grid, because it's not just the lights going out, it's the loss of all electronic communications and the internet and everything else. And just think how much worse this last pandemic would have been if we'd lost the internet doing what we're doing now.
Yes.
That's really, really serious. In fact, I quote in my book on the future a report back in 2012 by the US Defense Department, where they contemplate a cyber attack on the electricity grid on the East Coast of the United States. And they say that's so serious, it would merit a nuclear response. And what's very scary is that that sort of cyber attack, which may have needed a state level effort then, could now perhaps be done by a small group aided by AI, because AI aids the cyber attackers, and there's an arms race between the cyber attackers and cybersecurity people. It's not clear which side is winning. So I think cyber attacks on basic infrastructure are, as we're seeing, they're pretty common, and they could be in some cases catastrophic.
Lord Rees, do you think that we've emerged from this health emergency with a better understanding of risk?
Yes, certainly. I think with an awareness that we need to take things seriously, and many scenarios which would have been unlikely or impossible in the past are now becoming more likely because of advancing technology which can be misused, and of course because of the greater interconnectedness of our world. So we do depend on global communications, etc., and global supply chains. So I think the probability of various classes of catastrophes is growing. And of course, I've not talked about at all the separate kind of catastrophes, the slow burning ones like climate change and causing mass extinctions and all that, which again are aggravated by the fact that there are more human beings on the world, each more demanding of energy and resources. And these are, of course, a separate issue, which are now getting higher on the political agenda.
I must say, if I was in your shoes looking at this stuff every day, I'd be a real pessimist.
Well, I mean, I am a pessimist. But what I'm pessimistic about is the ability of our nations and their political leaders and governments to actually address these questions optimally. I think there is this very big gap between the way things could be with optimal planning and the way they actually are, given the muddle and incompetence which is manifested in all governments. I do worry about this.
Have you got any views on these recent political shenanigans, the woke debate?
I think it's perhaps a reflection of how comfortable our lives still are, that people do worry about these matters. We have this issue about whether you should dename buildings, take down statues, and all this sort of thing, and control speech that may offend someone. I think most sensible people, and certainly at least 90% of the faculty in Cambridge, take a fairly robust view. They decided in a very strong vote that although we had an obligation to tolerate other opinions, we did not have an obligation to respect other opinions. And I think that is the right thing for a university to do, to encourage robust debate, but not expect that we should keep everyone comfortable.
These are trivial concerns in your view.
It's potentially a serious issue. And I think one worries about the way in which some people expressing what would seem quite widely held opinions, you know, like J.K. Rowling, etc., are being attacked. I think you as a journalist must be more concerned about this, but I think there has been an excessive tendency to worry about making people feel uncomfortable.
Lord Rees, thank you very much indeed.
But one thing we didn't say anything about was space, which is my other main interest, of course.
Well, what is happening in space?
Yes. I think space is, of course, part of our lives, though we don't realise it. We depend every day on sat-nav communications, environmental monitoring and all that from satellites orbiting the Earth. But, of course, what people ask about is, what's the role of human beings in space? And my line there is that the case for sending humans was never very strong, except for political purposes like in the Apollo program, but it's getting weaker all the time as robots and miniaturization get better. And so I think all the valuable uses of space, including even assembling large structures in zero G and trying to explore the surface of Mars, can be done by robots. And I would therefore, as a taxpayer, if I was in America, not support the human spaceflight program of NASA, because it's very, very expensive. And that's because NASA is very risk averse. They launched people into space in the shuttle. And you may remember there were two crashes of the shuttle in 135 launches. And each of those was traumatic because they presented space travel as something normal, you know, like tourism. And of course, it should be presented as something which is not of very much use, but is a sport, a very dangerous sport for pioneers. And my view, if I was an American in particular, is that human spaceflight should be left to Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and their projects, because they are not using public money, and they are also able, therefore, to cut costs and take just the kind of people prepared to accept high risks, or even just one-way tickets to Mars. And Elon Musk himself has said that he wants to die on Mars, but not on impact. And I think he's about 50 years old now, so 40 years from now, he might do this. So my view is that human spaceflight is becoming less and less helpful and useful, because robots are getting better, but it remains much, much, much more expensive to send and sustain humans in space than to send robots. So it should be left to private enterprise and private sponsorship and pioneers who we would cheer on because they're doing something very dangerous and risky. So I rather hope there will be a few people living on Mars at the end of the century, but I think it's a dangerous delusion to think that we will ever have large communities on Mars. And I know there's some people, including Elon Musk himself and my late colleague Stephen Hawking, who felt that there should be mass migration to Mars to escape the problems of the Earth. But that is, I think, very misleading, because living on Mars is far less comfortable than living at the top of Everest, at the South Pole, or in the ocean bed. And dealing with climate change on Earth, which is, of course, a big challenge, is a doddle compared to making Mars habitable and terraforming Mars. So it's a dangerous delusion to think that there'll be mass emigration. Although, as an astronomer, I hope that there will be a few crazy people who do go to Mars. And the reason I say that is that astronomers are aware that not only are we the descendants of a long-term evolutionary process, 4 billion years of Darwinian evolution, but the time lying ahead is even longer. The sun's less than halfway through its life. So we are not, as most people think, the sort of top of the evolutionary tree, the end of a system. We're not even a halfway stage. And so we think that there could be a lot of future development, maybe flesh and blood creatures, maybe electronic creatures who are sort of post-humans, and they will spread far beyond the Earth, because if you're electronic, you may not need an atmosphere, you may prefer to be in space, and if you're near immortal, you don't mind a long voyage. So there's a future, which of course science fiction writers have familiarized us with, which is something which we just can't conceive. We can't conceive the brain power of these entities, etc., but it's a very exciting potential development. I think one point, and this was the theme of my most recent book, which is that even in this perspective of a concertina timeline extending billions of years into the past and also billions of years into the future, this century is special. It's the first when we have the future of the planet in its hands, because humans have the technology to either produce an Earth which is habitable by everyone, or if they screw up badly, to produce a major setback which forecloses all these immense options spreading millions, even billions of years into the future.
What do you imagine future man will be like?
I've no idea, because of course one thing which is going to be possible is redesigning humans modifying the human genome and producing genomes which are different. But I think the big question is, if we think very far ahead, will the dominant intelligences be flesh and blood, or could it be that the electronic entities will take over? Because obviously there are limits to the capacity of the kind of hardware we've got in our heads, and maybe the machines, which can already obviously surpass humans in many respects, may take over. We don't know how that will happen. But I think the other point is that this future evolution will happen not on the timescale of Darwinian evolution, which operates on a very slow timescale, taking hundreds of thousands of years to modify humans. We haven't changed very much in that time. But this will happen on what I would call the timescale of secular intelligent design, just like technology, and technology can change in a century or two. And so one prediction I make in my book is that 500 years from now, humans will be very different because of this sort of thing. And this has some important consequences, because whereas we can appreciate the art and the writings of people who wrote 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, classical literature and buildings, etc., because human nature wasn't very different then, we've got no guarantee that a few hundred years from now, the dominant intelligences will have anything other than some sort of algorithmic understanding of us and how we behaved. Their nature will not be human nature as we understand it now. And this is a big change. And this is something which is, I think, something we would try to slow down on Earth. We'd like to keep Earth changing fast and let these guys out in space develop these techniques. But this is the kind of thing which could happen. And of course, when I've talked about this, the reaction I get depends on whether people think that these entities are conscious. If they are conscious and self-aware and have feelings, etc., then some people might say, well, just like we're glad that we have superseded apes as the dominant species, so we should be glad. But on the other hand, it's possible that these entities will have huge capabilities but zero comprehension, in the sense of having no self-awareness, no consciousness. And so if the universe becomes dominated by entities that can't appreciate its wonder and mystery and have no inner life, then we would not think that's an admirable scenario for the far future. So the question which is discussed by academic philosophers about whether machines can be conscious may become an issue of crucial practical ethics if we get to the stage when we have artificial intelligences which can reproduce many human types of behavior, but which we can't tell are zombies or have consciousness.
I'm rather glad that's we'll both be issue. Dead by then, aren't you?
Well, I am. Well, out of curiosity, I'd like to be alive, but clearly this will all be long before we're all dead. There are people, of course, who aren't happy about that. Ray Kurzweil, who's the high priest of these crazy futurology ideas, he's one of these people who wants to be frozen when he dies, and then resurrected when it's possible to download his brain and all that. And there's a company in Arizona which will freeze your body in liquid nitrogen, and allegedly they say they'll revive you. This is pretty crazy, but that's what he wants to do. And indeed, three of my academic colleagues in this country have paid for this. They pay in advance, and they have something around their neck so that if they die, they're immediately grabbed and frozen in liquid nitrogen. And two have paid for this. One's taken the cut price of just having his head frozen. And I'm glad to say they're all from Oxford and not from my university, because I tell them I'd rather end my days in an English churchyard than in a Californian refrigerator. But some people are serious about it.
They're clearly all overpaid.
I guess so, yes.
Martin, thank you very much indeed. Look after yourself.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.